Good morning. My name is Jackie. I'm an alcoholic. Good morning. First of all, I'd like to thank my higher power, who I choose to call Lord Krishna, for bringing me here this morning. I'd also like to thank the people in Group Conscious for allowing me this morning to share my experience, strength, and hope with a group of drunks. Namaste. I am honored. First of all, I'd like to read a little thing before I get into this from this Hazelton book. And this is ironic for me because I got up this morning, and I always read this each morning. And it's August 7th. That's the date. True enjoyment comes from activities of the mind and exercise of the body. In recovery, we work at taking better care of ourselves. We care for our mind and our body often. During our drinking and drugging, we ignored our mind and body. We probably ate poorly, and we pushed our body to the limit. But now, we're in recovery. Totally. We are to care for our mind and body as we care for our spirit. Our illness is the illness of mind, body, and spirit. So we let these three things take care. In recovery, we learn how to care for and love for all of these three things. That caught my attention right away. I'll just start off with my given name is William Jackson Scott II. I was born in Marietta, Georgia. I'm the oldest of three kids. I have a younger brother and a younger sister. Both my parents were born and raised here in Cobb County. They were high school sweethearts, and along came us. Both my parents were very active in the community. My grandmother was the secretary of the NAACP in our chapter, and so they were involved in all the civic groups. I'm talking about parents now. They were involved in all the civic groups, little clubs, all those things. And a lot of those happenings happened at our house. We had a full basement that wasn't finished at the time, so they had a lot of parties. A lot of parties. So the booze flowed. Booze was a part of my life since I took breath. As a matter of fact, my grandmother and her sisters were bootleggers. They owned what they called shot houses. And a shot house is a place where you go to get your liquor. And not only do you get these dollar shots out of these old snuff jars. You ever heard of Bruton snuff? There's no real Southerners in here. Okay, there's a couple people. They came in glass jars. And after people finished the snuff, this is what the bootleggers would use to have a dollar shot. And this is what they sold. They sold everything. They sold food. They sold whatever was stolen goods, whatever. This is what they did. This is how they made a living. Now, I got to try to make sure you understand that at this time, segregation was huge. It was Jim Crow. So it wasn't a whole lot of places for blacks to go to get their alcohol and so forth, unless they went to Atlanta. So bootleggers were, they had to happen. Now, the neighborhood I grew up in was fantastic. A lot of kids, a lot of people who worked at Lockheed Martin, a lot of people who worked at the railroad, post office, entrepreneurs. It was really a great neighborhood. It was a neighborhood where you could leave the garage door open all night long and not worry about a thing. But there was also a lot of alcohol. Alcohol in one corner and alcohol behind us. But you never know it until the weekends because everyone kept their homes up. My parents, I never saw them get drunk. I never saw them drunk. I knew they drank, but I never saw them drunk. My grandparents were alcoholics on both sides of the family. My dad's dad, my mom's dad and mother, they were both alcoholics. My mother's side of the family was rampant with alcoholism. So I got the gene. And I can remember my first drunk, and this is where I want to really start. My first drunk was probably about 9 or 10 years old. I was at my grandmother's house with a couple of cousins at a sleepover. And we were clowning around, having a good time. You remember the couches with the roll-out beds? We had one of those deals in her living room, right? So we're bouncing around, waiting for a horror movie to come on or something. And I decided to go into the kitchen and grab this big ball of wine with the screw on tops. And they dared me to drink it. Well, I took a couple of gulps, and they took a couple of sips. But I finished over half. And I was all over that house. And before you know it, I didn't fall asleep. I passed out. Well, the next morning when everybody was up and the breakfast was being cooked, and this is a Southern-style breakfast. We're talking about grits being boiled in the pot, We're talking about sausage being made in your palm of your hand, thick bacon, and the gravy is being made out of the grease from the sausage, and that's just good stuff. But if you're hungover, it stinks. All right? But I didn't really know what a hangover was. So I rushed to the bathroom, blow chunks. My grandmother's right behind me, and she says, "Boy, I think you're catching the flu." Well, I didn't have any response to that because I was sick. So she put me in a tub, tried to cool my temperature down, whatever. But the next thing I knew, the whole remedy, I had to bend over and take an enema in the ass. And not only that, the next thing I had was some castor oil. So that was the last time I drank for a while. It didn't really teach me a lesson because I'm hard-headed and I'm stubborn. But like I said, my parents were go-getters. They were above the grade, and I still have a lot of respect for what they did for us. If we went without something, we never knew about it. We never knew. They managed to put the three of us through a private Catholic school, and I think it really set the foundation for the three of us. My brother, who's here right now, love you, man, and my sister are very successful. They do very well. They're two responsible adults. They got my back. I have their backs. That school really set the stage for us, or set the foundation, I should say. But they also, as Catholics, you know, we serve wine, the real stuff. So being an altar boy and access to the church and everything, a few of us, we decided we were going to go up in the sanctuary one day and play around and clown around. So we go into the room, what they call the cloak room, where the robes and everything is, and open up a few doors, and there's the wine. So guess what? We passed it around. And I'll tell you what, that was the best day of recess I ever had in my life. I was running and jumping and catching balls and throwing shit. It was great. It was wonderful. And I remember that. So the next family reunion, when it came around, there was always a lot of booze. Whatever side of the family it was on, that was the first thing I gravitated toward, was a beer. Go sneak a beer. Then after that, I go sneak a shot. But either way, I just liked the effect the alcohol had on me, what it would do for me. And now, you know, you felt 10 feet tall. Fuck you, Ray. That's just the way I felt at times. You know, alcohol gave me that, what's that old Eagles song? That peaceful, easy feeling? You know, that's what alcohol did for me. Every time I drank it, I never had a bad experience as a youngster. Now, after St. Joseph, I decided that I wanted to enter the public school, and the public school of Scarietta High School, otherwise known as Marietta High School. At that time, it integrated for about maybe 7 years, so there was still a lot of hostility around, which I wasn't exposed to at St. Joseph, by the way. Early on, I didn't fit in. It was really tough on me. There were some classmates from St. Joseph there, but we did not really mingle it because there's 2,000 kids there. So we didn't really get to mingle that much. So as a result, I was a real loner. And so I got picked on a lot. And the one time I got really humiliated, it was during changing classes. I was a little guy. I need to stop saying that. I know, man. At any rate, we're changing classes, and these two guys followed me into the bathroom. I was going there to take a piss. These guys followed me into the bathroom, and as I pulled my trousers down, pulled my pants down, both of them shoved me into the urinal, and I pissed all over my pants, on my feet, everywhere. And I was humiliated. I mean, completely humiliated. I walked out. And I tried to get the attention of the teachers, but they weren't hearing it. They closed the doors on me, and the hallway's empty. All of a sudden, this custodian comes down the hallway, and he took interest in me, cleaned me up, took me to the principal's office, and they just about blew the whole thing off, like it didn't even happen, like I made it up. And the next bullying I experienced was in the cafeteria, where a kid came up, and he just walked up to my plate, my tray, and just took my cake out of my tray. And I was like, give it back. And he just walked away. So I did the St. Joseph thing. I raised my hand. I was looking for one of the sisters to come over and help me. But that didn't happen. It didn't happen. So I definitely didn't fit in with anyone. I didn't scuffle. I didn't fight with anyone about that. I just let it be. But then I met this other kid who was about like I was. He liked rock music. He liked motorcycles. He liked motocrossing. He liked the things that I enjoyed at the time. And we hit it off. And he was a smoker. So I started smoking Salem 100s. That was my brand. And then we started drinking this wine called Lightning Creek. MD 2020, better known as. And we were drinking it before class, after class. This was in the ninth grade. And we did this into about the 10th grade. My grades went to shit in a handbasket. I was sleeping in class. I wasn't doing none of the assignments. I was a horrible student. And it was because I had some type of a learning disorder. At St. Joseph, they gave you the extra that you needed. But in a public school, you didn't get that extra that you needed. Make a long story short, I was failing tremendously all the time. But I didn't care because I was drinking. Coach Ben Wilkins, who's an icon in the Marietta community these days, saved my ass. He knew I was an athlete. He pulled me to a side. He got me out on the varsity football field. And before you know it, all the drinking and smoking was behind me. And I was getting better a little better in the classroom. But football and baseball was my thing. And I got a lot of awards. I was a standout player in both sports. By the time graduation came around, I thought that I was eligible for a scholarship because I had a lot of awards. You know, I was a good player. I was a good athlete. But I didn't get any awards. And the reason why I didn't get any awards, I had poor grades. I had horrible grades. I think you get a 200 just for writing your name on the SAT. I got a 210. So I didn't do very well on the SAT. I didn't know you were supposed to read it before you did. So I didn't do very well. Well, you go forward a few months. I got an opportunity to attend Kennesaw Junior College. And at that time, you could go to that school and take remedial courses to improve your way of studying, your grade point average, and all those things, so that you can attend another school of higher learning. So I did that, and I was all in, because I wanted to play football again. That was my goal. And I achieved my goal. I got a walk-on assignment at an historically black college by the name of Morris Brown College. I attended Morris Brown College. I walked on. I had a 4.5-year career as an athlete. I became a scholarship player. I started 38 games. I played 156 quarters. Not that I'm in the stats, but. So I played a lot of football in college. I was a standout player. I was all-conference defensive back, all-city defensive back. By March, I had signed with an agency that was representing NFL players, and the draft came around. I did not get drafted. I ended up signing a free agent contract with the Seattle Seahawks. I went to training camp, showed my ass. I competed with the best in the world. I had a grand old time. We drank excessively. As a matter of fact, the first Friday of two-a-days, we were walking into the locker room, and I'll give you an example. In an NFL training camp, the crowd is about 2,000 to 3,000 people watching the practice. And as you're walking into the field house or locker room, whichever we want to call it, the crowd is lining up there getting autographs. And you're fighting through, really, because you're tired. You just want to get in, cool off, and go eat. And these people are getting autographs. Well, the first Friday I came through there, they had all these coolers lined up going into the locker room. And I was like, what are those coolers for? And then I saw this monster lineman open one of the coolers and put about 4 beers in it. The coolers were lined up with alcohol, were lined up with beer. So it was encouraged. I mean, we go to this place called the Watering Hole every night after practice and then come back to team meetings. So it was encouraged. But anyway, the NFL stands for not for long. So anyway, my career was short-ended after preseason. So after about a year after that, I tried to bounce around and get back in the league. Didn't happen. I had to get a job. Got a job at a big hotel. Got into loss prevention, and I was still drinking, but it was moderate drinking. I didn't drink every day, but I got a promotion. I did very well as an employee, and the management team liked me, and they trained me as a convention service manager. I was head of a big department over banquet set up, ballrooms, you name it. But we were also in charge of the liquor, setting up the bar, setting up all these things. And when all these vendors would come in and they bought booze, they couldn't take it back with them. So guess who got the booze? So I kept the booze in my office, and I started to make a shrine of liquor. And before you know it, I was putting Kluwer in my coffee before every meeting because the other managers were doing it. And then before you know it, I was having Jack Daniels in my coffee before I went to a meeting. And then before you know it, the general manager called me in his office and said, I have a customer complaining that you were slurring last night while you were trying to explain something to them. And it didn't give me a wake-up call at all that I was about to lose a great job. It gave me a quarterly income to go to different restaurants with a credit card. I didn't know that I was losing a job that was about to promote me to another facility in California. I didn't know all these things were about to transpire. My drinking had taken over then. I'd hitched up to alcoholism. That's when my drinking took off. As you can just about figure out, a few months later, they asked me to resign. I wasn't really ready to resign, but they gave me another option. They said, well, we'll let you go to another department, a demotion, and you can stay. So that's what I did, because I needed a job. I had to pay rent. And at that time, my roommate was a manager of a strip club. And so we weren't really sleeping well, especially on the weekends, every night, actually. I was at the club, drinking and getting high. And cocaine is a real big part of my recovery as well. Fast forward a little bit, I met my wife in between all that time, and we were drinkers. She was my drinking buddy. We loved Fat Tuesdays. Fat Tuesdays, all those little rinky-dink type places, that's what we liked. We loved those things. But unbeknownst to her, I was loaded before she even picked me up, before I went to pick her up. There was a drink that I love to drink called, it was Peppermint Schnapps 100 Proof. I love that stuff. And I thought that you couldn't smell it on me. And it was a big kick for me too. So that's what I drank before she would come pick me up. I would guzzle that stuff and then we would go out. And then before you know it, she's pouring me back into my apartment or disgusted with me about something I said or did. So we went to her family reunions together. And that was a big drunk as well. And I somehow sensed that she was pulling away. She was going to break up with me because of my drinking. So I decided to propose to her. And I proposed to her at her family reunion in front of all her family and friends. And she cursed me out the whole way home. You know, I'm not into that controlling type thing. But the alcohol told me that if I don't do something, something else is going to happen. It had taken control of me. At the time I proposed to her, a lot of great things were happening in her family financially. So I figured I would have a chance to ease my financial burden as well. But it turned out to be more chaos than help. After the wedding, I'd say 7 months after the wedding, the marriage was pretty much over. But I hung on to it because of pride and ignorance. So my son came along, and my drinking increased even more. I hated to come home. When I did come home, the first thing I did was go get me a drink. The first thing I did. Then it got to the point where when I left work, I had to stop and buy booze. Immediately. Once I clocked out, I made a beeline to the liquor store. If I was running out of gas, I made a beeline to the liquor store. So finally I figured out if I buy these little packs of minis that you get at the airport, those little mini shot glasses, shot things, and pile them in my glove box, then I wouldn't have to stop. So that's what I used to get home every night. Once my marriage started to come to an end, I met a young lady. I had an affair. I met a young lady. She drank with me a little bit, but my drinking subsided a little bit, and my mind started to clear. And as a result, I left my wife, filed for divorce, left my wife, cashed in all my 401k, cashed in all my my stock that I had with Big Brown, and went into the single life. Well, I tell you, when somebody doesn't stay in your life, and which she did not, I became lonely. And you know who became my best friend? The bottle. Alcohol became my new best friend. And I drank excessively. I showed up at work driving expensive package cars, we call them, totally drunk, sometimes right after a blackout, behind the wheel. I've had a supervisor come to my place and wake me up from a drunken stupor and come to work. And all they wanted was to get the packages out of the building back then. That's all they cared about. And I didn't care if I was drunk at work. I had customers who would ask me, Jackie, do you drink? Yeah, I have a couple of glasses of wine. But I was probably going through a little over a fifth a week, and booze, and beer, and cocaine. I don't know how I stayed with UPS as long as I did. Apparently I did something right. But the loneliness really kicked in. And all I could think of was where I was going to get my next drink from. And it got to the point where alcohol wasn't working anymore for me. It stopped working. I did not realize that. So I brought more people into my chaos. I met a young lady. We started dating. She's the mother of my youngest child. She tried her best to get me to stop drinking. If any of you are familiar with anyone's ever hid liquor from you, you know how enraged you can be. That's happened to me a couple of times where I really wanted to put my hands on that person, but I did not. I restrained myself, and I just went to the bar and just left. And she ended up leaving me with the keys on my table, and all I did was lock my front door and continue to drink. Because alcohol was my new girlfriend. It was my lover. It was my best friend. It did everything for me. I went to a Super Bowl party about a year later, and I saw an old friend there. And he told me, he said, you know, you're living in this apartment life, man. You need to get your house. And I was making really good money. I had a little money saved up, too. And I said, yeah, I'm looking to get me a house. That's a good idea. Save you some money. Tax write-off, all that kind of good stuff. Well, some people come into your life, they're really not looking out for your best interest, but you think they are, but they're not. And sometimes you find out at the last moment when that happens, and that happened to me. Got into closing with this house that I loved. Got into the closing part of it. Of course, I showed up drunk. Fell out of the car. One of the ladies who was in the room said, Mr. Scott, you got some on your lips right here. And it was cocaine. We were in the parking lot getting high. So I said, oh, sorry. And during closing, I discovered I needed to come up with another $5,000. I had the money, but it would clean me out. So I went and got the money anyway. I closed on this house. The guy took the money and ran. He took me to the cleaners. I went from paying $760 in rent to paying $1,600 in a mortgage. And this was like 2006. And I wasn't making that kind of money. The house was beautiful. I loved being there. It was neat. I kept it up. I had this massive stereo system in it. I had it well furnished. I kept it up. So I figured if I drank myself to death and they found me dead in here, at least they'd say, God, he was doing so good. What happened? He was doing so well. I mean, look at it. Look what he's got. The materialistic world took over. The materialistic world took me down another dark road that you wouldn't believe for me. I went from drinking two-fifths a week to half gallons a week of vodka. Just like that. This was every day. I was a walking liquor still. I don't even know how I even functioned that year. Fast forward to Christmas, peak season. That's a very busy time for us at UPS. And during that time, I had a problem swallowing, and I couldn't understand what was going on. And I called my doctor and got an appointment with him, and he got me in his office, and he looked me over, and he said, you know, I think something else is going on besides your throat. He said, I don't see anything wrong with your throat. So he handed me a couple of sheets of paper with some psychiatrist names on them. Of course, I looked at him and saw psychiatrists and threw him away. Like, oh, I'm not doing this shit. There's no way. So I continued to drink. And I found out that the only time this problem I had with my throat would go away was when I drank. And I got to the point where I woke up one morning in my bathroom, in my own shit, and piss. I'd fill up and I hit the counter and burst my lip. I was on the floor and there was blood running across my fingertips. And there were those little tiny black ants, they were crawling across my hands. And I thought I was dead. In my mind, I thought I was dead. I got up, cleaned myself up, and drank again. Went back to work again, as if nothing happened. It took another couple of weeks before I took a couple of days off from work because I was so hungover. And then finally, when I went into work, showed up to work that morning on a Friday, I walked up to my union steward and I said, I can't do this anymore. He said, do what? And I said, I need to talk to the center manager. I need help. So they drug me in the office and I told him that I had a drinking and drug abuse problem. I need help. And the center manager looked at me and he said, you know, that's the bravest thing a person can do coming in here. But I didn't feel brave at that time. I felt about that tall. Shut up, Ray. I felt about that tall. And my heart sank because I didn't know what they were going to do to me. I thought they were going to put a bullet in my head now. What are they going to do? I don't know. But instead, they checked me into a treatment center. I checked into a treatment center January 15th. My sobriety date is the 17th. The first person I called was my best friend, Kent Brooks. I called him, and he was surprised I was in a treatment center. But I explained to him how much I drank, and he nodded. I mean, he said, yeah, well, you know, you got to do what's best for you. And I spent the next 3 months in this treatment center, and then I went to the outpatient. In the meantime, I got a sponsor. I started to work the steps. I had a great sponsor at the time. They called him Old Man Willie. And I remember when I initially started to do the steps, he said, I told him, I said, I can't do this. I can't do this. I can't even read the stuff in this book. Why do you call it the big book? It's only about so big. But that was my rationale. And he looked at me and he just, matter of fact, said, I guess you haven't had enough pain yet. And that got my attention because I was really hurting. I wanted some relief and I didn't know the solution. And I found it in the 12 steps and I also found more relief in the traditions. But at the time, I didn't know how well it was going to work in my life. I had no idea. Well, I talked to someone about losing my house. And if anyone's ever lost a house or been foreclosed on, it's not a pretty experience. When I lost my house, I was devastated. I couldn't afford the payments. I was behind on payments. I was too proud to ask someone for help, which I probably would have gotten, but I just didn't. I just let it go. I ended up in an apartment. And I kept going to meetings. I had 90 and 90 to go to do. And I also had to report for a year for drug and alcohol. I had to call in this hotline, whatever it was. But things started to really fall apart. And this is early on in my sobriety, about a year in. Things started falling apart for me. I was already paying child support for my oldest son. Then I got another child support payment from my youngest son. Then the IRS said, we'll take a piece of that too. And I ended up being garnished for $586 a week. And I was making good money, but not that good money. So as a result, I was homeless in about 3 months. I had my stuff in a storage facility, and I had to wait for about a week before I could get another check so I could find me a decent place to live. So I was taking a Walmart shower. So the Walmart in Roswell is where I parked for about 5 days in my car, and I slept in my vehicle. And I still went to meetings. I still called my sponsor. I still did the work. I still read the literature. I didn't let up on my spiritual principles. I still prayed. I still did my meditation. Fast forward, I ended up in a roach-infested hotel full of drunks and crackheads and all the worst stuff you can think of. And I did not drink. I still kept going to meetings. I started getting sponsees. I started to get involved in a church, my old church at St. Joseph. I got involved with them. Things started to look bright for me. Before you know it, my oldest son was off my child support thing. Before you know it, the money I owed to the IRS was paid off. My check was looking a lot better. Things were brighter. I was actually going on vacations. Liquor never crossed my mind. I guess I was probably about 8 years in about this time. And I'd really picked up on my spiritual program. Prayer, meditation was a daily thing for me. Before I even entered my job, I did those things every morning. Fast forward to 2018. Okay, running out of time. I had an accident at work. Hurt my back. So I had to go and work Ms. Comp. And I went on work Ms. Comp. I had to do all this therapy, chiropractor, all these evaluations, MRIs, all these things. And finally got to the point where I could not do that job anymore. I'd been there 29 and a half years. I think I'd done my part. So I decided to go ahead and take my pension and my full benefits, which was a real blessing. During that period of time, from January through to around I don't know where, I had let up on my spiritual program. It disappeared. It no longer existed. I was not praying. I was not meditating. And guess what? Those are all character defects crept up, and I welcomed them with open arms. And before you know it, that funnel cloud came over my head, and I was in a deep depression, and that funnel cloud was over my head, waiting to touch down to somebody's life. By the middle of 2020, I found myself in dire straits. I was running out of money fast. The holidays were coming up. I had no money. I needed a job. I couldn't find anything. I did not drink. I was going to meetings. I was networking with other alcoholics. But the stinking thinking had kicked in, and this little whirlwind of people in my head started running around. And before you know it, I was sleeping 12 hours a day, called myself taking naps. I was trying to check out. In that time, one of my closest friends on Thanksgiving Day passed away. Well, it threw me for a loop. But it didn't really hurt me that much. 2 months later, in February, my closest friend, my best friend, my ace, my buddy, my man, Ken Brooks, passed away. He had congestive heart failure. I was completely crushed and devastated. I didn't know which way to turn. I didn't know whether to shit or go blind. A month later, my other close friend named Kevin Gibbs died. We were all four of us were. He passed away, and I was the only one left. Now, with my selfishness and all the character defects I had going on, I was angry because they didn't take me with them. So I wanted to die. I didn't want to take my life, but I wanted to die because my life was over, because I wasn't going to laugh anymore. I didn't have any more friends to hang out with. My spiritual program was all but gone. It was all but gone. I had no backup plan. I had nothing. I was on the verge of another drink. I was on the verge of a drink. And then something amazing happened for me. A lot of events happened in between that, of course. But something amazing happened for me. I met someone in here a couple of years ago in the reading rooms. You know, some people you meet, you never would think they would have an impact on your life. You know, you see these people, you know, that, man, they can't teach me a damn thing. You ever meet somebody like that? They can't teach me shit. There's no way. Well, this person was in the gym with me a lot. I exercise. I exercise a lot more now, but I love exercising. So I see him in the gym every once in a while. We talk, we exchange pleasantries, whatever. Also in the room with me, I see him every once in a while. But I still had that bitterness in me. I was still very angry. And one day we were having a conversation on the phone, and I said, we were talking about something. I was ranting about something, cursing, and just raising hell. And he stopped and he paused. He says, "Man, you cuss too much." And I was like, "Fuck you, man. I do all I want to do." And he started to chuckle a little bit, and I figured, I said, "You know what, man? You're my new fucking sponsor. You know that?" And he was like, man, you're stupid. I said, yeah, I am. I am. So that's the way Ray became my sponsor. And Ray and I, we hit it off immediately. And Ray got me to work right away. I'm putting you on the spot now. He got me to work right away. And he asked me, he said, are you willing to try a new spiritual group? And in the big book, it talks about we always look for other ways to find a spiritual connection. I don't quote the big book a lot. I just remember some tidbits. But I agreed. I said, I'm all in. I'm all in. I'm in pain. I'm all in. I'm at the point where I'm at the jumping off point. So whatever. So I went down on a Sunday evening, Sunday afternoon for the first time. And I got to admit, I had a spiritual experience there. I clearly had a connection immediately. I was involved with some people. I met people who were truly had humility, honesty, and taste. It was an incredible experience for me. I could shake my head and cry and moan about everything. But when I finally surrendered, and that's when I finally surrendered again, when I finally surrendered, I came alive again. And here it is, 9 weeks later. I don't feel the same way as I felt at that time when I first walked into that group that changed my life. It enhanced everything that we do in these rooms. It brightened everything that I read in the literature for me. I've become more connected with my higher power than I ever have in my life. We equate it to a vibration, and I feel that vibration when I walk into these rooms. I feel everyone's spirit in here. Although it's a little bitty God particle, I still feel that particle. And sometimes I look back in my life and I said, I can't believe the things I endured and I'm still standing upright. And it's all because of my higher power. And because I became God conscious. And I learned that in order for me to show love, I have to love God and I have to love myself. An iconic figure that I followed before by the name of Louis Farrakhan says, you have to fall all the way in love with yourself. And when I first heard him say that, I was like, you're such a prick. But he is so right. You can't show love unless you love yourself. And I had to love myself because I hated to look at myself in the mirror. And today when I look in the mirror, I see hope. I see humility. I see a chance at life again. Because I wanted to end my life, and my life was about to begin. I want to thank everyone for here today. And one thing I want to say is we have a ton of food over here. And we do not need to leave it here. We need to pack this stuff up and go give it to someone who needs it. Because someone's going to be hungry tonight. Somebody's going to be hungry this evening. I've been there. It's not a fun position to be in. So let's don't waste this food. Let's gather it up and get it out of here this morning. Please. That's all I got. I mean, I am so happy to be here. Thank you for your time and your patience. Namaste.